investors gave the developer the money he said he needed to complete the development. Unfortunately, the contracts did not really obligate him to finish the project, and the contracts also prevented the investors from replacing the developer, even if he completely failed to finish the project. The lesson here is to insist on clear contracts that obligate the parties to do what they have agreed to do and to have a lawyer represent you who is looking out for your interests and protecting your rights. You are entitled to contracts that spell out precisely what you expect to happen in the real estate deal. Contracts that reduce the uncertainty and keep ambiguity to a minimum. You also want to make absolutely sure the other parties are required to do exactly what you expect them to do and when you expect them to do it. Spell out the consequences if the other parties do not do what you expect them to do. By the same token, you also want to know what the consequences will be if you do not or cannot uphold your side of the agreement. A good lawyer can help you define and limit your downside as much as possible in those situations. Later, we'll talk about limiting remedies in more detail, but here's some legal advice. If you are not sure you can perform under the terms of the contract, then you should not sign it. Beyond these words of wisdom, take the time to read and understand the contracts you are going to sign. In doing so, your real estate broker and your lawyer can give you all the help you need. Let them help you identify any risks that others will not perform or that you cannot perform, and make the necessary changes to fix the problems. Don't hesitate to have things explained again if you do not understand. And don't worry about looking stupid. The more you understand, the smarter you will get. The stupid thing is to sign a contract you really do not understand. Tip: you are entitled to contracts that spell out precisely what you expect to happen in the real estate deal. Contracts that reduce the uncertainty and keep ambiguity to a minimum. You also want to make absolutely sure the other parties are required to do exactly what you expect them to do when you expect them to do it. Carefully specify and limit remedies in the contract. Much of the uncertainty regarding real estate contracts can be eliminated by clearly specifying remedies. For example, real estate contracts often provide that the seller's only remedy if the buyer defaults is to keep the buyer's deposit. On the other hand, if you are a seller, you want to limit the buyer's remedy to just getting the deposit back, and you want to specifically preclude the buyer from getting what is called specific performance. Specific performance is an equitable remedy that gives the buyer the right to legally compel the seller to sell the property to the buyer upon the terms in the contract. If the buyer is arguably entitled to specific performance, the buyer may have the ability to tie up the seller's property in court for years while the parties litigate their respective obligations under the contract and who did what. This could effectively give the buyer an option on the seller's property for years with only the deposit at risk. This is not where you want to be if you are a seller. If you cannot completely negotiate out specific performance, you want to limit the situations where the buyer is entitled to seek specific performance as much as possible. Let me share with you a story of how powerful specific performance can be. I represented a large hotel chain in litigation that resulted from the failed sale of a trophy resort hotel in Honolulu. The buyer had failed to perform according to the exact terms of the contract, so my client finally canceled the deal and kept the buyer's $1 million deposit. The buyer had also spent more than $200,000 on a lengthy due diligence before my client canceled the contract. Had I been involved earlier, I would have recommended that my client give the buyer more time to perform and would have carefully positioned the buyer before canceling. But by the time the case got to me, the contract had been canceled and the buyer had sued. We asked the court for summary judgment without a trial, based upon the fact that the buyer had not met the time deadlines provided for in the contract. We got lucky, and the federal court gave us summary judgment against the buyer. After the hearing, I advised the top management of the hotel chain that we had been very lucky to get summary judgment, and that the court's decision might be reversed on appeal. I told them that they did not want a premier hotel tied up for years by the buyer's potential right to specific performance while the appeal got resolved. I recommended that they use this opportunity to settle with the buyer by returning some of the deposit. But warmed by the glow of victory, they refused to offer the buyer anything, and I was reprimanded by a senior partner for spoiling our victory with my dismal predictions about an appeal. To make a long story short, I left the firm with some of my colleagues to form our own firm, and someone else handled the appeal. Years later, after the hotel had increased 50% in value, the appeals court ruled that the buyer should be allowed to proceed with the purchase of the hotel at the original price, with full credit for the deposit the seller had retained. Tip: here are some words of experience. Limit the buyer's right to specific performance whenever possible. Always try to resolve the dispute instead of rolling the dice in litigation. In that case, the seller's failure to limit specific performance and insistence on keeping the buyer's $1 million tied up a premier hotel for years and resulted in the sale of an $80 million hotel for $55 million. Not a good outcome. Avoid problem people. Do not do real estate deals with people who are likely to be trouble down the road. Some people get into disputes with everyone. You want to do online litigation checks on people you are considering doing business with. If they have been involved in a lot of litigation, you want to avoid them. This is also another good reason for you to avoid litigation, so that other people will not avoid doing business with you. Conversely, you want to do business with people who have a history and reputation for working things out when a real estate deal hits a rough spot. You want to have a mutual trust and respect for the other people involved in a real estate deal whenever possible, especially a real estate development project that will go on for several years. Tip: do online litigation checks on people you are considering doing business with. Avoid litigation so people will do business with you. Rough spots are sure to come up, and potential disagreements are certain to arise. You want to be involved with people who will work them out with you, not make a mountain out of every molehill. The last thing you want is someone who will blow up your deal in litigation to prove they are right. Avoid problem deals. Some deals are just more trouble than they are worth. Some deals get more complicated, involved, and difficult as they progress. And the more complicated and difficult the deal becomes, the more likely there are to be disputes later on that will be difficult to resolve. So when the deal gets more and more difficult and the brain damage mounts, you need to ask, is it worth it? Is this deal so good and so beneficial for you that it is worth the brain damage and risk that is inherent in complex, difficult deals? Some are worth it, and you may want to continue. Most are not, and you will be better off letting those go. Let someone else deal with all the headaches and problems if the potential benefit to you is really not worth the trouble. If the benefit is there and you decide to go ahead, then the help of a good lawyer and the need for clear contracts become doubly important. However, even a good lawyer can do only so much to overcome the risks inherent in a difficult deal. Tip: the more complicated and difficult the deal becomes, the more likely there are to be disputes later on. And problem people and problem deals often go hand in hand. The purchase of a large ranch that I helped a friend put together several years ago was a deal that was just too difficult and complicated. A limited partnership owned the ranch, and the general partner who originally formed the group that owned the ranch had sold his interest to a stranger who had gotten into litigation with the holder of the grazing license. In order to buy the ranch, my friend had to put together another partnership composed of some of the partners in the original partnership that owned the ranch and some new investor partners. We also had to get a federal farm loan, renegotiate the underlying ground lease to extend it to 25 years, settle the litigation between the general partner and the licensee, and resolve the disagreements among everyone as to how all this should be done. I was the person responsible for doing all of this. As I look back, the brain damage, work, and stress involved in trying to put this extremely complicated deal together clearly outweighed any gain. The deal finally collapsed of its own weight when the buyer went on a long-planned, month-long family vacation when the deal was supposed to close. Luckily, no one involved got sued. We just wasted a lot of time and money on a deal that was just too difficult and complicated. Another point to consider is that problem people and problem deals often go hand in hand. Clear contracts can go only so far in controlling problem people in the context of a problem deal. The probability of serious disputes that will be difficult, if not impossible, to resolve without litigation goes up exponentially. Some experienced real estate developers and investors would say that no deal is worth going through the brain damage, emotional drain, and risk of problem people and problem deals, and would advise you to just walk away from them. I will just say that the problems will be more numerous and much worse than you expect, so you need to be sure the deal is really worth it. A few deals are that good, but the vast majority are simply not worth it. Do a thorough due diligence, including legal due diligence. Due diligence is a period of time designated within a contract that allows a buyer to check out the property and the deal before committing to close. Usually, the buyer's deposits are refundable until the buyer notifies the seller that the property and the deal are acceptable. At that point, the buyer's deposit goes hard, becomes non-refundable, and the buyer is also usually required to increase the deposit so that the buyer will lose a substantial amount of money if the buyer fails to close. This non-refundable deposit also gives the seller comfort that the deal will close. Tip: if you are a buyer and you think a deal is worth doing, then it is worth spending the money to do a thorough due diligence, including careful legal due diligence. If the deal is big, then you need to spend a substantial amount of money to check it out carefully before you agree to close. Many disputes can be avoided if you check out the property and the deal very carefully before you commit to close. If you discover problems or issues at the due diligence stage, you can insist that the contract be amended to fairly deal with the problems you have discovered. If you need more time to complete your due diligence, show the seller the effort you are making and the money you are spending on the deal, and ask for an extension of time. You will usually get it if the seller is convinced you are proceeding in good faith, but sometimes the seller won't feel that way. I recently had a development property in escrow and delayed the legal due diligence to save money. I instead focused a lot of time and money on planning the proposed subdivision and locating an adequate water source for the property. When I finally started the legal due diligence, my lawyers discovered an unusual legal restriction that prevented us from developing the subdivision project we had planned for the property. As a result, all the money we had spent on engineering and land planning was completely wasted. How to avoid real estate disputes. Avoid disputes in your real estate deals by doing the following. Work with a good, experienced broker. Consult with a good, experienced lawyer early and often. Insist on clear contracts that protect your interests. Carefully specify and limit remedies in the contract. Avoid problem people. Avoid problem deals. Do a thorough due diligence, including legal due diligence. How to handle real estate disputes. Even if you follow the steps I have outlined, no contract is perfect, and conditions may change in ways that may make the deal more difficult for one or more of the parties. As a result, disputes can arise, even when you have clear contracts with decent people. One party may also just want to try to improve the deal after it is agreed upon. So how do you handle the disagreements that do arise in your real estate deals? The simple answer is that you should always do your best to work it out. In doing this, you may want to consider the following suggestions. Consult with a good, experienced litigation lawyer to avoid litigation. Strangely enough, a good litigation lawyer knows better than anyone that litigation in real estate deals seldom pays off, and also knows the best ways to avoid it. While helping you avoid litigation, an experienced litigation lawyer can also put you in the best possible position if litigation cannot be avoided. He or she can also make sure you do not give up the farm or get bullied by the other parties. There is usually some middle ground between getting pushed around and doing your part to resolve disagreements. A good lawyer can help you find that middle ground. But here is a fair warning. Litigation lawyers make a lot more money by representing you in litigation than they do in helping you avoid it. Some do not have enough work and may have a financial self-interest in prolonging your dispute or even aggravating it. Some lawyers also are just enamored with the litigation process and get carried away with protecting your position to the point they lose sight of the real objective, which is resolving the dispute for you as quickly and cheaply as possible. You do not want these unbalanced lawyers representing you. You want lawyers helping you who have the experience and good judgment to strike the right balance between protecting your interests and resolving your dispute. Tip: Experience warning. Litigation lawyers make a lot more money by representing you in litigation than they do in helping you avoid it. Choose carefully. When disputes arise, do whatever you can to work it out. As I have said, disagreements may occur in real estate deals even though you have had clear contracts prepared by a good lawyer. Generally, the more complicated the deal and the longer it lasts, the more likely there are to be disagreements. For example, a joint venture agreement to develop a planned community over a 10 to 20 year period is almost certain to involve a number of disagreements, while the sale of a house in as-is condition for cash to close in 30 days is much less likely to generate disagreements. My advice is, when disagreements arise, you should do your best to work out the disagreements as soon as possible. This can usually be done by respecting the other party's interests while protecting your own. There is no need to force the other party to live up to the letter of the contract if you can accommodate their legitimate interests without hurting yourself. You are almost always better off giving up a little ground, generating some goodwill, and resolving the disagreement before it becomes a serious dispute. Here are some suggestions. Respect the legitimate interests of the other party and try to accommodate them whenever you can. There is usually a way to respect the other party's interests while protecting your own. For example, if you are selling a property and the buyer wants to extend due diligence for 30 days, figure out a way to do it, maybe by getting a cash payment. This point is demonstrated by a case I handled several years ago for a very wealthy client whose name some of you would recognize. He was buying a large oceanfront resort property for development, and the seller refused to extend the time for due diligence in a situation where it was reasonable to do so. The seller's refusal to extend due diligence and abrupt cancellation of the sale precipitated a lawsuit by my client that tied up the seller's property for years and eventually led the seller to sell the property to my client for about $2 million less than the contract price, even though the real estate market had gone up. All this could have been avoided if the seller had just given my client a 30-day extension for due diligence. Generate clear correspondence to the other side with the help of your lawyer. This will often help avoid litigation, and if not, this correspondence will be valuable evidence for you in any litigation. You can usually make substantial concessions to resolve disputes and avoid litigation and still come out way ahead. The cost of litigation is always higher than you expect. The case always costs more than you expect, and there are hidden costs. The emotional cost of litigation can be overwhelming for many people, and the lost time, energy, and opportunities can also be huge, and may be more expensive than the direct costs of the lawyers and experts who participate in the case. The adage, avoid litigation at all costs, is only slightly off the mark. Tip. You are almost always better off giving up a little ground, generating some goodwill, and resolving the disagreement before it becomes a serious dispute. Try mediation. When you have tried your best and have been unable to settle the dispute directly with the other party, you may want to try mediation. Mediation is an abbreviated dispute resolution process where an experienced professional helps the parties reach a voluntary settlement of their dispute. A number of years ago, when mediation was first used, it had a very high success rate, between 80 and 90%. In recent years, the success rate is much lower. Today, the mediation process is only as good as the mediator. Highly skilled, experienced mediators still maintain a high success ratio, while less skilled mediators probably succeed in less than half their attempts. Mediation can work when you select the right mediator, and that is probably the most important factor in a successful mediation. The second most important factor is a mutual desire by the parties to resolve the dispute in the mediation. Mediations used to take place in one day, but today a good mediator may work for as long as 1 or 2 months, going back and forth with the parties to resolve a dispute. A good mediator will put in whatever effort it takes to succeed. I was the mediator appointed by the court to resolve a series of interrelated cases that were estimated to use up 1 year of court time if they were not settled. That mediation lasted several months before I succeeded, but it saved a fortune in lawyer's fees and court time. It was well worth the effort I put into it. Tip. Mediation can work when you select the right mediator and when there is a mutual desire by the parties to resolve the dispute. Another way to improve the odds for success in mediation is to begin the process with a comprehensive settlement offer that includes all the details of a settlement. You then want to insist that the negotiation of major terms take place within the context of this comprehensive agreement, so you will know exactly what you are agreeing to. Mediation is relatively inexpensive if it is successful, and is much better than any other method of formal dispute resolution. However, if it is unsuccessful, then nothing has been accomplished, and the mediation will have been a waste of time and money. Because mediation can be so efficient and effective, many real estate contracts require mediation before arbitration or litigation. I recommend that you include a provision requiring mediation in most contracts. Several years ago, I represented a client in a case that seemed ripe for mediation. The parties decided to pay a blue ribbon mediator $10,000 for 1 day, and we all flew to San Francisco to have him mediate the case. Although the mediator was very experienced and had a good reputation, he completely screwed up this mediation and failed to get any concrete settlement offer out of the other side. My client was so anxious to resolve the case that he made repeatedly lower offers to the other side without any counteroffer, all contrary to the instructions his business advisor and I gave him repeatedly. The client negotiated against himself throughout the day and reduced his settlement offer from $500,000, which was a fair deal for the other side, down to something substantially under $100,000, which the arrogant folks on the other side should have jumped at. The case finally settled years later when the vice president of the real estate title insurance company, who was himself an attorney, called me directly and said we had to settle the case right then. He said that he could no longer take the amount the case was costing. He indicated his lawyer's fees had already exceeded $1 million with no end in sight. I recalled that his attorney had bragged after an earlier hearing in the case that he had bought a new car with the fees from the case. The title company finally agreed to pay my client $850,000 in cash to settle a case that could have been settled at the outset for less than $100,000 in the mediation. I estimate the total cost to the title company was well over $2 million, all because it did not accept my client's offer in the mediation. You should avoid making this mistake. Consider arbitration. If settlement fails and mediation fails, you may want to consider arbitration as an alternative to litigation in court. Arbitration is a trial conducted by an experienced arbitrator paid by the parties instead of a judge or jury who are paid by the federal or state government. Many real estate contracts require arbitration instead of litigation. Where the contract requires arbitration, then the parties are required to resolve the dispute by arbitration, and any court litigation initiated by either party based upon the contract will be dismissed by the court in favor of arbitration under the terms of the contract. The arbitrator hears the evidence and makes a binding and final decision based upon the evidence and the law. Your ability to appeal a bad decision made by an arbitrator is very limited. Arbitration used to be quicker and cheaper than litigation, but today it is unclear whether there is any net benefit to arbitration over litigation. Because the arbitrator is getting paid, and a refusal to hear all evidence may be grounds to upset the arbitration decision, arbitrations can tend to go on forever, can become more expensive than litigation, and may not get the case resolved any quicker. The quality of arbitrators can also vary greatly, with some having difficulty deciding cases correctly. Because the benefits of arbitration are unclear, the trend toward requiring arbitration instead of litigation in real estate contracts has been curtailed to some extent. The arbitration requirement has now been deleted from some real estate contracts in favor of traditional court litigation. For example, the standard real estate purchase contract used by real estate agents in Hawaii was recently revised to delete the mandatory arbitration requirement. To me, arbitration and litigation are now a toss-up with no clear advantage to either. If your case is assigned to a good judge that your attorney has confidence in, then you should stick with the judge. On the other hand, if your case is assigned to a poor judge and you can agree with the other side on a good arbitrator, then you may want to opt for arbitration. For example, both sides in a court case I handled recently agreed to arbitration instead of going through the litigation process. We selected a very experienced retired judge as the arbitrator, and my client just received a very fair award that the other side has paid in full. In that case, the arbitration was completed promptly and worked out very well for my client. Tip: arbitrations can tend to go on forever, become more expensive than litigation, and may not get the case resolved any quicker. Because the benefits of arbitration are unclear, the trend toward requiring arbitration instead of litigation in real estate contracts has been curtailed somewhat. Litigation is your last resort. If you are unable to resolve the dispute by negotiation or mediation, and your contract does not require arbitration, then you are left with litigation. As I said earlier, litigation can be very expensive and emotionally draining. The direct cost, meaning cash, can be very high, and the indirect costs in terms of wasted time and emotional energy can be even higher. But there are also opportunities to resolve the dispute. The court will usually agree upon a request by either party to conduct settlement conferences in an effort to resolve the case early and without the expense of a trial. The court may also appoint a mediator to help settle the case. In my experience, a court-appointed mediator has a better chance of success than one without court backing. In one case, where I was acting as a court-appointed mediator, several of the parties were not even paying their own lawyers or returning their phone calls, much less contributing to a settlement of the case. Because I had been appointed by the court, I was able to get the presidents of those large companies on the phone and get their attention with some direct talk. And eventually I got their cooperation in contributing to a global settlement of a number of complicated interrelated cases. There may also be opportunities to file motions to decide or limit issues in advance of the trial. However, generally things are not going well if you are embroiled in the litigation process. If you end up there, then you are left with no alternative but to do your best to win with the understanding that it will be very expensive. A case earlier in my career demonstrates the financial and emotional toll that litigation can take. I recall sitting at the counsel table in court in the morning, waiting for the trial to resume. The man on the opposing side was sitting at his table, waiting for his lawyer to arrive. I could not help feeling sorry for him. He looked so dejected. His lawyer had refused to settle the case, and he had been forced to go into this trial that was not going well for him. Things took a turn for the worse when the sheriff came in and served him with a complaint in a separate case that had been filed against him by his own lawyer to collect the fees he was owed. This caused a great deal of dissension between the client and his lawyer, who arrived a few minutes later. The dissension lasted through the rest of the trial and probably contributed to the large monetary award the court made against this poor individual. Leaving aside the ethical problems with his lawyer, this graphically demonstrates the emotional and financial cost of litigation. Tip. The direct cost, meaning cash, of litigation can be very high, and the indirect costs in terms of wasted time and emotional energy can be even higher. Never quit trying to resolve the dispute no matter where you are in the process. Always keep in mind that mediation, arbitration, and litigation are only means to an end, resolving a dispute. No matter where you stand in these processes, you should never quit trying to resolve the case on some basis you can live with. Never quit trying to work things out with the other side. Also, never hesitate to take the initiative in trying to settle. Don't worry too much about appearing weak because you have taken the initiative. Only a fool would not want to settle a case if it is at all possible. The other side is probably not having any more fun than you are, and as both sides get progressively more fed up with the time and expense of litigation, they may be more willing to settle. So never stop trying to come up with alternative ways to resolve the dispute. Several years ago, I represented the developer of the only large new oceanfront hotel developed in Waikiki over the past 20 years. The owners and residents of the condominium apartment building across the street had opposed his project from the beginning through their association of apartment owners. They had contested the shoreline permit required for any oceanfront development in Hawaii, and had appealed the granting of that permit all the way through the court system. They also contested a number of zoning variances that the developer required for the construction of the hotel. To say that my client had a great deal of animosity toward these people would be an understatement. I filed a motion in the case to have the variances upheld as a matter of law, so that my client could proceed with the construction of the hotel. The argument before the judge went very well. We were well organized and made a clear, compelling presentation using visual aids, while our opposition made a sloppy, disjointed presentation. The judge also appeared receptive to our arguments. To observers in the courtroom, including my client, it looked like we were sure to win. I told my client after the hearing that I thought the judge's positive reaction was because of my favorable relationship with him, and that my intuition was telling me that we were going to lose the motion and the variances that would sabotage his plans for the hotel. My client was not buying it. He was at the hearing, and he was confident we were going to win. Nevertheless, I started negotiations with the lawyer on the other side for my client to make a cash payment to the condo association in exchange for dropping its opposition to the variances. The association finally agreed to accept $150,000 to drop the case. My client refused, even though this case could sabotage his $100 million hotel project if he lost. He was also infuriated with me for wasting time and showing weakness by negotiating with his enemies. He told me to stop dealing with them and just wait for the judge's favorable decision. I got the judge to postpone his decision and continued to negotiate a reduced amount with the association. The client also rejected that offer and threatened to fire me. I continued to negotiate. Finally, the association agreed to accept $55,000 to settle the case. My client was very angry with me, but I kept calling and recommending that he accept the offer. I pointed out how small the amount was and how much was at stake. He told me never to call again about the offer. I continued to call. He again threatened to fire me. I did not let up, and he finally agreed to accept the offer and paid the $55,000 to settle the case. My client considered it a complete waste of money, since he was confident he was going to win. I went to see the judge after the case was settled, and he told me that he thought all the variances were wrong, and that he was going to strike down all of them. Shortly after we settled the case on the variances, we won the appeal on the shoreline permit, and my client was able to proceed with what is now a beautiful oceanfront hotel owned and operated by another one of my clients. So this story had a happy and profitable ending, which is your goal in all real estate deals. The moral here is this: keep trying to settle, and never take the risk of an adverse court decision if you can avoid it. So, don't reconcile yourself to trudge down the path of seemingly endless acrimony and litigation if you can get a resolution you can live with. You are almost always better off settling than you will be by taking the risk of an uncertain outcome in litigation. Because of the complication of real estate deals and the limited remedies that can be provided by the court, in many situations, a settlement is often a much better resolution for both parties than litigation, even for the winner. In short, you may not be able to get what you really need from a court decision, even if you win. How to resolve real estate disputes. Try to resolve the disputes you cannot avoid by doing the following. Consult with an experienced litigation lawyer to avoid litigation. When disputes arise, do whatever you can to work it out. Try mediation. Consider arbitration. Litigation is your last resort. Never stop trying to resolve the dispute, no matter where you are in this process. Conclusion. You are almost always better off settling your disputes in a reasonable, fair way that respects the interests of the other parties while protecting your own, than you are having the dispute decided by an arbitrator, a judge, or a jury. And most of all, the best solution is to avoid disputes altogether by going into the right real estate projects with the right people, the right mindset, the right contracts, and the right legal representation.
Bernie Bays is a partner in Bays, Deaver, Lung, Rose, and Holma, a boutique real estate firm based in Honolulu, Hawaii, and is one of the few attorneys in Hawaii who is board certified as a civil trial specialist by the National Board of Trial Advocacy and the Hawaii Supreme Court. During his 38-year career, Bernie has represented clients in landmark real estate cases before the Hawaii Intermediate Court, the Hawaii Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court. His experience encompasses a broad range of business and real estate cases, including the representation of minority and majority shareholders, corporate proxy fights, antitrust representation of both plaintiffs and defendants, as well as litigation concerning real estate sales, commercial leases, land use problems, rent renegotiations, claims for economic loss and lost profit, property damage, general and limited partner disputes, condominium and subdivision problems, land valuation issues, and condemnation.
Part 2. Your Real Estate Project. 7. Mel Schultz. Buy by the acre, sell by the foot. Understanding real needs, financial logic, and asking questions. Mel is my neighbor. We met at a neighborhood holiday party. I liked him immediately because he is a real estate developer and was a longtime owner of two professional sports teams. There is nothing like sitting in the owner's seat at a Phoenix Suns basketball game. The players, cheerleaders, and the action are much more intense at the court level. Usually, I sit higher up and need to use binoculars to see the game. One of the advantages of having a friend like Mel is that I get to find out where the next growth areas are going to be. Being a land developer, he is operating 3 to 10 years out into the future. Not only do his developments expand the city, Mel and his high-profile team are responsible for bringing new life back into downtown urban areas. Mel is a great neighbor, friend, and a real estate visionary. Whenever I want to know about the future and where to invest, I call Mel Schultz. Robert Kiyosaki.
Have you ever been driving around your city or town and passed by an open field and wondered if that field might be the only undeveloped land in the area? I asked myself that question many times and actually found it pretty fascinating. I found it so fascinating, in fact, that the question itself actually jump-started my real estate career, and the discovery became my strategy. Driving through your city or town can reveal a great deal about real estate. For instance, you may have noticed that houses tend to dot the interiors of most cities and towns, while shopping, office, and other commercial properties generally run along the major streets. This all makes sense once you start to notice and make mental notes of how most cities and towns develop. In the late 1970s, driving around seemed like a good way to find real estate. I didn't own any sophisticated tools other than maps and a car to explore opportunities. Although I did buy one of the first giant mobile phones that looked and felt like a brick. Driving along the main streets of my city provided all the options needed to buy property during this time before instant information. When I saw larger parcels that were skipped over by development, yet were right in the path of growth or on the beaten path, it made sense to find out who owned these underserved parcels and inquire about the status. It seemed pretty simple and obvious. However, there were ample spots that were ignored by most land buyers and developers. Finding the owners was just one call away to the title company. Once I found the owner's number, I handled it just like I learned in my insurance business training. Pick up the phone and meet the prospect. These prospects were slightly different, though. Rather than the buyers I was used to calling, this time I was calling sellers, and I was offering to give people money rather than asking them to write checks. Hard to believe, but it's always easier to buy something than it is to sell. Think about it. In your own life, you'll find it to be true. The problem is that the owner knows that what they own is valuable, so it's worth holding on to. On the other hand, the owner may not want to go through the process and the risk of investing the time and money it takes to plan and perform feasibility studies, as well as other land use studies that may be required to develop the property. Even though real estate can be very tax favorable, the process and final entitlement received on the land may negatively affect the tax status for some owners. We always discuss these kinds of tax issues with our tax advisors to be sure we are never crossing the lines, or if we are, to be fully informed of the negative tax implications. This is a complex part of the equation, and I absolutely recommend finding the best real estate tax counsel before even beginning to zone or make any changes to a piece of real estate. It is just as important to understand the tax and legal aspects at the beginning of a property transaction so you can get off on the right foot, as it is to understand the same implications when selling the property purchased. This cannot be emphasized enough. Talk to professional tax and legal experts. I regularly hire and talk to CPAs and lawyers before getting too far down the road in real estate. My brother's law practice was the logical entry place for me. It is the oldest law firm in Arizona with expertise in all areas of real estate. I believed from the beginning that a portion of my investment dollars were to be earmarked first for the land and second for lawyers and other consultants who could better my chances for success. The value of a team is self-evident. I always wanted to be the quarterback of our team at school. I knew the position was less about heroics and more about being sure the best support was in front of me. My job then was simply to remember the plays and throw or hand the ball to the best players. Tip. The Dictionary of Real Estate Terms, 6th edition, defines entitlement as this: the right to develop land with government approvals for zoning density, utility installations, occupancy permits, use permits, and streets. Matching market needs with product creation. Just because you buy a hotel doesn't mean it has to stay a traditional hotel. Just because you buy an apartment building doesn't mean it needs to stay an apartment building. Markets change, market needs change, and in order to be successful, you may find you have to change a property from one kind of product to another. Here are a few examples. Converting a traditional hotel into a timeshare property. Converting a rental apartment into a for-purchase apartment to the renter or another buyer. These are examples of matching market needs with product creation. Space that already existed was transformed to create new revenue sources based on market demands. When it comes to land, changes may involve simply splitting one larger lot into two or more residential lots, or changing land permitted for one use to a different use that is usually better economically. Most often, this requires the approval of the city or town, municipality, to consent to the proposed use change. This is called rezoning and/or the entitlement process. Real life story: the education on 32nd Street. In the mid-1970s, I bought a house on about 5 acres for $240,000. Within a short time, a friend asked if he could buy the home. His intent was to change the zoning from one house per acre to commercial or office use. He offered to pay triple my price with the caveat that the closing had to wait for up to 12 months. He figured it would take that long to convince all the residents on the north and south sides of the property to agree, and the city to approve his rezoning plan. This was my first personal experience watching someone change the use, rezoning, of a property. I was in my mid-20s, and it seemed worth waiting a year to make such a compelling profit. Time passed, his rezoning was approved, and we closed the deal. This was an early eye-opener. Suddenly it hit me. I could add value by changing the use of the underlying land. I decided this was to be part of my new investment path. Real life story, view from the mountain. With confidence from my 32nd Street experience, I purchased the 29,000 square foot McCune Mansion in Paradise Valley, Arizona. The monstrous mansion was built by oil tycoon Walker McCune in the 1960s for more than $3 million. The mansion sat on 40 acres of hillside that overlooked the entire city and the spectacular Camelback Mountain. My plan was to change the use from a single home to a resort. The city fought the rezoning, so I decided to go with what they called preferred residential zoning, which included the Hillside Ordinance. This is where I truly became a real estate developer and gained firsthand knowledge about the zoning process and lot layout. Each lot building pad had to meet complicated cut-and-fill requirements, how much you could cut into the mountainside and fill back in to create a building pad. I ended up on the committee with real home builders rewriting the town ordinances for slope and hillside cutting and refilling. In the process, I found a buyer who purchased the mansion for the price I paid for the entire 40 acres and mansion. The sale included the mansion and 5 acres, which I carved out around the house. I then held on to the remaining land, which was now converted into 28 one-acre-plus home sites. The lots sold from $200,000 to $600,000, and I had made my biggest profit yet. I retained one lot to build a home for my family, but the desert snakes were not my friends, so I made the decision to sell at a later time. Sales topped $10 million. My early experience with a mansion on the mountain got me thinking about the economics of the land business. There's a story about Abe Lincoln's farm that makes the point about creative financial engineering better than I could ever make on my own. It seems Abe Lincoln bought his family's farm from his father Thomas when cash got a little tight as a way to bail him out. Eventually, after Abe became president and one of the great figures of our country, the Friends of the Abe Lincoln Historical Farm near Lerna, Illinois, took on the ownership. It seems the owners of this land had a brilliant idea. They wanted to give the people of Illinois and the nation the opportunity to own a tiny piece of American history in an effort to raise money for the owner's family. They planned to sell off small parcels of the estate to interested people. When they parceled out the designated acre, they had more than 6 million squares to offer the public. The net return on this is not known, but even with a low price for the land parcel, I am sure it was substantial. This is the ultimate subdivision of land, almost beyond the scope of imagination, but I'm sure it won't be the last ingenious idea. If I had to start over today in the real estate business, what would I do? I can answer that question this way. In the late 1970s, we would joke about a wealthy private lender and investor named Bill Levine. We'd say that if he were dropped out of a plane with a parachute on his back in the middle of China and with no money, within a few years he would be one of the wealthiest men in China or wherever else he happened to fall. Some people just seem to know how to create wealth. They are the true financial engineers. Tip: starting is the hardest part of anything in life. In the early 1970s, I had saved up about $5,000 from my life insurance sales commissions. A real estate firm in my building had several older, unoccupied houses it was trying to unload. Inside these old house bones lay bright red carpeting, purple-painted walls, and linoleum floors from the 1950s. Even the carpet stains were better than the original colors. The cash requirement to acquire these homes was straightforward. Pay closing costs, include a few $100s in commissions, and assume the debt. I thought, why not? I soon found that renting these showplaces was not easy, because after I had purchased the properties, I didn't have enough money to repaint and update the interiors, nor did I have the mechanical skills to do it myself. But somehow, enough renters were willing to take the houses and do their own fix-ups. From the cash flow I received, I was able to buy more houses and sell some along the way, accumulating about $10,000 in cash. I didn't like the rent collection process much, so after selling my last house in 1973, I immediately moved on to something a little more sophisticated. My first office building was just east of 24th Street on Thomas Road in Phoenix, Arizona, as were my second and third buildings. My logic was, after buying my first building and not knowing where else to buy, it seemed like a good idea to go next door and buy those buildings too. If it hadn't been for other opportunities that came my way, I may have just kept buying along the same major road in Phoenix. What did I know? These small office buildings were, for me, where it really all began. After selling the first building and making $30,000, I began to get some traction. The next two were sold as a package with $130,000 in net profit. A California syndicator was looking for more buildings in Phoenix, and I liked the idea of negotiating the purchase and sale. My strategy was to buy and improve the properties, much like the houses I owned, except this time I wanted to be able to afford to hire contractors. After my house experiences, I learned to set aside cash up front for this purpose. The old painted white brick needed a modern look, so we put in new windows and doors, added beige-colored stucco to the brick exterior, new signage, and a parking lot. This clean new exterior brought the building back to life. First impressions are lasting. Starting off with real estate math. Getting started with basic real estate math is helpful to me. There are 43,560 square feet in 1 acre, and there are 640 acres in a section of land. The question arises regarding land uses and valuations. Commercial land is a higher economic use than a similar size residential-sized lot. In the course of planning, developers study the market demands and the appropriate use of a parcel of land and determine the best land use before buying. The planning and zoning process, which I learned after my house buying experience, incorporates the information learned along with the market demand to create the highest and best use. With that said, consider the math for a parcel of land. Buying by the acre and selling by the foot. This example may help you see the potential of real estate in a new way. The purchase price of 10 acres is $50,000 per acre, or $500,000 total, zoned for 10 houses. The final plan for 10 acres may be 250 apartment units, which may be worth $10,000 per unit or $250,000 per acre after rezoning approval. This equates to about $5.75 per square foot. 43,560 square foot times $5.74 equals $250,000 per acre. Since the land was acquired for single family and changed to multifamily, the underlying use created an increased value of 5 times the original purchase. Usually, landowners sell large parcels of unzoned land in areas outside traditional development cores in bulk at a per-acre price. In urban areas, commercial or multifamily property is usually sold by the square foot. It's really a convenience because it all reverts back to the dollar amount paid for the land, the ultimate sales price, and profit. This practice is convenient for both the buyer and seller. It's similar to the way we use inches as a measurement division of a foot. For example, rather than say it's 1/4 of a foot, we say 3 inches, which is easily understood. Perhaps smaller measurement practices were used to influence